Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, January 6th. This is our first Speak Up of 2025. My name is Magnus Tiefeld, and joining me here on the show today is...
I go by Peter R.H.
And we have a bunch of stuff lined up for you today. Peter's going to be pleased because we have lots of local birding content on
That's
the program
right.
today.
Let's keep it British Columbian if we can, too.
But we also have a lovely episode of Bird Note as well. We have a special report from Jesse Wentzloff on the use of indigenous knowledge and indigenous languages in conservation of endangered species. What are you going to be talking about today, Peter?
Well, last week, Candleland, we have it on from 5 to 6 here on CJSF.
Yeah. And it's 5 to 6 on Mondays. Tune in 90.1 at 5 p.m.
Yes. Anyway, so I'm a bit incensed by the last show.
Okay.
Because they said, oh, it's holidays. We're going to do something from the New Yorker podcast. They call it Candleland, and yet there was nothing Canadian about it. And no, but that's not what I'm incensed about, is that the person who did Hamilton, you know, the Broadway play?
Yeah.
He has not done a Broadway play on the 1979 film The Warriors, but he did some, like an album. Mm-hmm. Like, you know how Tommy from The Who was like...
Yeah.
And I was a bit incensed at the shallowness talking about the film, because actually two people died because of this film, supposedly. And I had never seen the film.
During the filming or as a result of the message in the
film? No, because in a movie theater or something in New York and one in the West Coast in Los Angeles. No, it's I never saw the film. I saw it. And it's not as... I mean, the Barbie film isn't as bad as this. So Robin likes the Barbie film. We talked about that 2 weeks ago. So Robin's off the hook because this is worse. Right. And also I'm going to talk about, because I got some information on the Guardian Angels. This was this group that paroled the
the New York subway and the city in general.
Well, what
I remember
happened,
you know, wearing red berets. And
what happened was that they had picketed the film in early 1979, and then I got a bit of information on that too. So it's
all right,
all
that's coming up at about 10:45.
Yes, 10:45.
The Warriors and the Guardian Angels
and Jesse Brown was out of line for putting that on. Maybe we'll contact him.
All right. Big news today here in Canada is, of course, that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that he will be stepping down both as Prime Minister and as leader of the Conservative Party upon conclusion of a leadership race for the new leader, and that person will take over as Prime Minister. And, of course, in order to give time for that process to happen, he's going to be proroguing Parliament until March 24th. Giving them about 10 weeks to run a leadership process. And, of course, the prorogation of Parliament was necessary because the opposition parties were signaling that as soon as they get a chance, they would be voting for non-confidence. Or at least the Conservatives were certainly going to push for a motion as soon as possible, and the NDP had indicated that they would not support the government, and that would lead to the government losing that confidence vote and falling. And I guess the Prime Minister wanted to see the party had a chance to undergo that process for a new leader before facing such a non-confidence vote.
Yes. I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yep.
I was paying attention.
It's interesting. I expect that, you know, in social media and elsewhere, the conservatives are going to be completely losing their minds over this, over the fact that the Prime Minister prorogued Parliament, which basically means they basically shut down the current session and they start a new session at the day. So there'll be a throne speech and all that stuff when that happens. So I did do a little research into other prorogements, and the Conservatives need to be a little careful if they're going to get too upset about it, because Prime Minister Harper used prorogation twice explicitly. Well, the first time in 2008, it was very explicitly to avoid a specific impending non-confidence vote on his minority government. And it really sort of went down like it was Friday, and the opposition parties were going to bring a motion forward in the next week of non-confidence that Harper would not have won. So he prorogued Parliament specifically to avoid that vote. One of the other really significant times, and then he did it a second time as well. He used the process twice again to avoid a political problems that he was going to be facing in Parliament. One of the other really significant times that prorogation was used was under our first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, who used it in the 1870s to avoid a corruption investigation into his administration, and he shut it down, and then but wasn't able ended up running into some additional political problems and wasn't able to form a new government, and then the Liberal Party under I forget his first name. I just read a little while. Mackenzie, but not Mackenzie King from later on, formed a new government.
Well, I saw the National Dream in the 1970s, mm-hmm. which was a televisation of the Pierre Burton book. Mm-hmm. And I remember that it had John A. Macdonald, and then he came back. The other person you speak of became prime minister, and then John A. Macdonald came back as prime minister after that.
Yeah. I expect there'll be lots of political controversy stirred up around this prorogation. Although I would say, and I'm not necessarily saying this to defend the Liberals or Trudeau, but it does seem to me in the best interests, if we're going to have an election, which it seems we will as soon as it's, as soon as Parliament returns, that it's probably better that we have that election with each party actually having its leader in place. I don't think we would be served well. Certainly it would hurt the Liberal Party very much to go into an election without a new selected leader, because people wouldn't know what they were voting for in support of them. But it does seem sensible that time should be given for parties to get their house in order, get a new leader, and then when we do go to the polls, we're actually know who the leaders of each party is and people can vote appropriately.
Well, this new leader will probably go the way of John Turner and Kim Campbell.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. I don't, there's not really enough time for a new leader to put a new face on the party and put behind them the negative feeling that has gathered around Trudeau and also gathered around any government that's been in power for coming on 10 years now. So it's a steep job for anyone who comes into that position.
Yeah. Well, when Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones came to town, did you hear about this? He said something. It's on YouTube.
I did not hear this.
So what happened is that he incidentally he said, "Oh, you're it's a wonderful country, and you got a wonderful Prime Minister Justin Trudeau," and everybody started booing him. And he started talking about, "You guys won in a soccer thing, championship." Everybody started clapping. So
yeah,
it's anyway,
interesting. The other thing that's a big thing happening today. Is, of course, it's the four-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection down in Washington, D.C. Because today is the day, and it's happening in Washington today, where they will certify the results of the 2024 election.
One thing I'm a bit confused about, that wasn't inauguration day. That was prior to it, because I thought, why it happened, was it the same date 4 years ago, January 20th?
No, well, what's happening today and what happened on that day was they were certifying the results of the election, right? So okay. I don't know the exact particulars of the process, but basically Congress has to say, yes, this we acknowledge and this is the results okay. of the election, right? It's sort of an right. official step in the process to say, yeah, the election happened and these are the results and we agree with them. And what part of what Trump was wanting to see happen was that because he contested, he, you know, was making the claim that, you know, the election was rigged and he really won and not Biden. And so he wanted to prevent or have his supporters prevent that certification of the election. And then if there's no certification of the election, then the next steps coming along in that process, which would be, I suppose there's a bunch of them, but coming up to the inauguration of the president on the 20th, wouldn't be able to go forward until that certification happened, which would have left him in power. And, you know, who knows how that all would have played out. I mean, wouldn't it just rolled along towards the goal he wanted? But it would have certainly sparked some sort of constitutional crisis. And so that process is happening again today with Kamala Harris, who will be, because I guess the vice president is part of the process of officially certifying the results. They have to sign off on it or something. And so Kamala Harris will be doing her job in certifying the results of the 2024 election that saw
in a more low-key way, in a more low-key way, I imagine.
I doubt it will happen, but I kind of hope that she will sort of make some sort of comment in speech about how, you know, how wonderful it was that the process went through in a peaceful transition, and that unlike 4 years ago when the sitting president, sparked a riot in the House, we today under Joe Biden, we're seeing it. Just something like that. You know, it'd be a nice burn against Trump. But I doubt that'll happen. They'll all be polite and that'll be the end of it.
Mm.
Sometimes I think Americans are too polite when it comes to...
We're supposed Canadians are polite. So that's the stereotype. But we're here in the West Coast. I'm a very impolite person, so... I'm bucking the stereotypes today and tomorrow.
Well, how are you bucking the stereotype tomorrow?
Well, because I'm kind of, I'm like an honest person, but I can be rude, or that's what is said of me at times. So I'm not your stereotypical Canadian in that way.
Great. Okay, well, let's get on with some of our stories today. As I said, we have some local birding content for those of you who like birding or just like... stories about how we are seeking to preserve our local environment. This is a story from our friends in Nanaimo by Lauren McKenzie about winter birding.
While the temperatures drop and the sun sets earlier in the day, no matter the weather, Oceanside birder Bonnie Mullen is encouraging people to keep an eye out for wintering birds as the BC Bird Trail celebrates its fifth anniversary. The BC Bird Trail offers via website and phone app first-time and seasoned birders, that is people who enjoy observing birds, the resources to find new and popular locations to find birds native to the region. For the Central Vancouver Island area, the BC Bird Trail says that in the winter months, popular birds around the area during the colder months include loons, scooters, and auks. Mullen says while birds may migrate to warmer locations during the winter, there are still many interesting birds to look at in the Oceanside area.
there isn't really migrating birds just yet. It's too early yet, but lots of gulls and different kinds of ducks, like goldeneye and mallards, and the eagles and the great blue herons are around all the time, and they nest over there.
For the BC Bird Trail anniversary, CGY met with Mullen at her favorite birding spot at French Creek Marina, where French Creek meets the ocean. Mullen spoke to CGY inside her car, where ducks, seagulls, eagles, geese, and a barking sea lion filled the water and the sky outside.
Is that a crane or a heron right there?
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever seen one so close before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's a great blue heron. Yeah. Wow.
She says that although in the winter, it tends to be the usual birds to watch, she still goes out whenever she can because every new day could be a new bird to see.
Because it's a wonder. You never know one day. You might see some kingfishers one day, you know, and which are really neat to see. And so you just never know. Or you never know when a great blue heron's going to come and sit on the pole right beside you, you know? So it's always fun.
Mullen says the French Creek Marina is her favorite spot to bird watch, as there are always many birds to see.
True, but just because this is just a place where there's action kind of all the time. Because there's flowing water, that's fresh water coming out, the river's coming out here to the ocean. So you get some birds that like fresh water and some like seawater, and so here they get the mixture. Depends if the tide's coming in or going out right here in the bay. So
while the biggest groups of birds locally can be found in the French Creek area, other spots Mullen recommends for bird watching are along the Englishman River and at Raftover Beach Provincial Park. At 78 years old, Mullen is a member of the Arrowsmith Naturalists, who monitor and work to protect and preserve the natural habitat of the region. Mullen takes part in their brant count, where from the end of February to April, the group counts the number of brant geese at different monitored locations.
Then we start about end of February, and it goes till like into April until we don't see them anymore, because they winter down in the Baja Peninsula, and then they come north and they stop here to eat, and they wait for the herring run. And on the herring run, that's when they really like to eat, because they can really stock up on lots of food, because they go to Alaska for their nesting and breeding and nesting for the summer. So we count them when they come through here.
Brant geese are small and short-legged, known for their distinctive black head and neck with a white small line that circles around the neck. The count results are then given to BC Nature and Nature Canada for the research. Mullen says she's seen as many as 1,500 brants in one day in one monitored area. Each spring, Parksville hosts the annual Brant Wildlife Festival, connecting people to the biodiversity of the central Vancouver Island region. While the 2024 numbers for the brant count are not done yet, Mullen says there's been a decrease in the number of geese counted.
We're always fighting against people that want to pave everything. You know, there's more to this world than pavement, but some people don't seem to understand that.
Mullen says the decrease in the number of brants can be attributed to the loss of habitat while development grows in the area.
There's other groups around, like there's several naturalist groups on the island, and we have different groups in town, like that are fighting to save waterways or fighting to save. There's stream keepers that are trying to save the rivers and stuff. Like, you have to have the rivers for the birds and for everything, for the fish, the birds need the fish, and you know everything's interlinked. It all worked perfectly until man came along. Man always comes along and screws up everything, you know.
While they're advocating for the brants, Mullen says there is a big community of birders in the Oceanside and Nanaimo area that meet up regularly to look for birds.
Oh, you'd be surprised what you see and what, you know, what they do. And every time you can learn something new about something in nature, you know, you never know. It may lead you down a path that you think, oh, I want to know more about that. Yeah. Because it's very interesting.
Mullen says no matter the season, for people new or returning to the world of birding, there will always be something interesting to see when taking a chance to get out in nature and taking the time to stop and watch the birds. For more information on the BC Bird Trail and lists of popular birds for each region in the province, check out their website at www.bcbirdtrail.ca. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change and comedy are not a natural pairing. But a few years ago, comedian Stuart Goldsmith started to feel depressed about climate change.
I just found that I couldn't really talk about anything else. I wasn't thinking about anything else. And as a result, I brought it on stage with me.
He began filling his routine with jokes about everything from the challenges of remembering a reusable food container to feeling smug about having a lower carbon footprint.
In comedy, we talk about the problems. The problems are the material.
Climate change can be a depressing topic.
It is so easy to feel like, oh, God, you're not going to mention the climate again. My wife, bless her, she's had to put up with so many versions of me being asked about it in a social event.
But he says that talking about it as part of his show has reduced his feelings of dread. And he wants to help his audience feel empowered to find their own way to take action on climate change.
I think if we all feel as bleak and hopeless and despairing as I have sometimes felt, if people feel like that, I would like to give them some comfort and to feel better, because people who feel better and happier and more united and mobilized can take more action.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now I'll take a quick look at Vancouver weather. It's, it's wintertime, so sometimes it feels like the weather's always the same. We're just going to be looking forward to a bunch of clouds and rain. It's actually not looking that bad tonight. For today, we have pretty clear out there today. Highs up to 7. It's going to be cool down to one degree overnight. Mix of sun and cloud tomorrow. A bit of overnight rain, and then it's a few days of cloudy weather, a little bit of rain, but not much. And it looks like the sun is coming back out for a mix of sun and cloud for Saturday and Sunday, with temperatures ranging up to 8 or 9 degrees during the week and down to, pretty much the same overnight until we get some clearing weather at the end of the week when we get overnights down to 1 degree.
As an incidental point, it hasn't snowed yet for the winter of 2024-2025. Usually it snows one time. And I've been keeping track since the mid-1990s, and it does.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't had a snow yet. No, snow is sort of interesting because when it tends to be cold, it tends to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
When it warms up, it gets cloudy, and you get the rain. So snow is sort of it needs both. Needs to be cloudy and cold.
And typically when it's cloudy, it warms up to above. I remember as a kid, that used to be always the crushing disappointment, is that, you know, you'd get a bunch of a stretch of really cold, clear weather.
Yes.
And then the clouds would come in and with the promise of some precipitation. And you think, oh, fingers crossed for snow, right? But, of course, as soon as the clouds rolled in, the temperature warmed up, and you'd go from, like, you know, under 0 Celsius, you know, to, like we have now, like 6, 7, 8 degrees, and it's like, oh, there's not going to be any snow.
Well, snow was sort of an incidental thing. Back east, starting in Alberta, I guess, when it's continual cold, that incidental thing will happen, that you'll get snow. But it is sort of a thing that's a slight oxymoron because it's usually cold and clear, and it warms up, it's cloudy. But it yep. happens, and we know we've had it.
Yep.
And every time we have it here, it's like it never happened before. Everybody.
Very true. It's interesting that we haven't had any snow. Typically, we get a really nice snowfall in November, but nothing like that happened this year. And I wonder, do you think we'll get any snow this year? Who knows?
We had snow on March 1st, 2024. Remember that?
Right.
There was recently.
I do know the North Shore Mountains are open with snow now, although there hasn't really been that many days of looking north to see the mountains frosted in snow in the morning yet. But apparently there's some skiing available, and I guess I'm sure Whistler is doing fine.
I'm one of the unskied. I've never skied.
I haven't skied for many years.
Oh, you've skied once.
Oh, I've skied a bunch. We used to go quite often when I was younger, but not so much now. Now I'd probably fall down and break a bone.
Oh, there was a joke. There was a political cartoonist, Roy Peterson, and he didn't like Pierre Trudeau, the father.
Yeah.
And there was a joke. They had a reporter ask, "Mr. Pierre Trudeau, you don't seem to care about what the actual conditions are in Western Canada." And they have him answering, "No, I care a lot. I care if it's going to snow in Whistler tonight." You know? So that was his little joke about the father of Justin.
All right, here we have a report from our very own Jesse Wentzloff about Indigenous knowledge and conservation. We'll be back in 15 minutes.
Researchers with the Canadian Wildlife Service are hard at work on the conservation and recovery of British Columbia's southern mountain population of woodland caribou, and are turning to a time-tested source of information about the iconic ungulates, Indigenous languages, knowledge, and perspectives. Since Environment and Climate Change Canada posted the recovery strategy for woodland caribou southern mountain population in 2014, progress has been hindered by insufficient mapping of caribou territories, confusion about territory types, and a lack of Indigenous consultation and representation, as many Indigenous communities have expressed the need for federal documents to better reflect their knowledge, perspectives, and languages. Dr. Jean Polfus is a senior species at risk biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service Pacific Region Division of Environment and Climate Change Canada, and is leading the work to revamp the recovery strategy with a focus on the deep connection between caribou and Indigenous identity, language, and knowledge. I spoke with her after her presentation, Indigenous Voices in Conservation, Language as a Foundation for Collaboration in a Caribou Recovery Process, at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby.
So we're working on a recovery strategy amendment for Southern Mountain Caribou, which are caribou that are found in the southern half of British Columbia and into Alberta across the Rocky Mountains. And the caribou in that region have been declining for many years, and some herds have been extirpated, which means they've disappeared. And so as part of an amendment process, we're trying to make sure that we work with communities, Indigenous communities who have an interest or relationship with Southern Mountain caribou, and so that their voices are included in the recovery strategy. Our main goal and hope would be that when an Indigenous community member opens this recovery strategy, this federal recovery strategy that's posted on the Species at Risk Act registry, that they actually see themselves reflected back in some way. And right now, with the version that is currently posted, which was posted in 2014, that's kind of not the case. It's a very Western scientific-centric version of a recovery strategy. And so one of the easy first places to start a collaboration like that is through respecting communities' wishes and language revitalization projects. And just a small step in that process is to include their language in this document. And so to begin that work, we did our homework and looked through the many resources that have accumulated online and in dictionaries and in libraries on Indigenous languages. And that all is through efforts from Indigenous community members and their language reclamation projects that are on the go and well supported by communities. So we looked through that for anything related to caribou, and we're able to compile a pretty big database of words for caribou. And then something new that we did as part of that work is we map them. So many maps that you find in federal Western kind of scientific reports and recovery strategies will have maps of the scientific names for different subpopulations of caribou or subspecies of caribou, and then all of the names that exist out there for the herds. And very little emphasis on what did people who maintained a long historic relationship with caribou, who depended on caribou in this region for their survival, actually talk about caribou, and how did they describe them, and how did they identify different